Genesis 18. The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after you may pass on, since you have come to your servant." So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly three measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. This actually could be another sermon, a classic example of Middle Eastern hospitality and how one might treat strangers. But we move on. This is only the beginning in this text. They said to him, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" And he said, "There, in the tent." Then one said, "I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife, Sarah, shall have a son." Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. She's actually 90. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too wonderful for the Lord?' At the set time I will return to you, and in due season, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. The Lord said, "Oh, yes, you did laugh." And may God bless this reading and hearing of this holy word. Reflecting on today's text, author and teacher Frederick Buechner has written this. She's an old woman, and after a lifetime in the desert, her face is cracked and rutted like a six-month drought. She hunches her shoulders around her ears and starts to shake. She closes her eyes, and her laughter is all china teeth and wheeze and tears running down as she rocks back and forth in her kitchen chair. She is laughing because she's pushing 91 hard and has just been told she's going to have a baby. Even though it was an angel who told her, she can't control herself, and her husband can't control himself either. He keeps a straight face for a few seconds, longer than she does, but he ends up cracking up too. The old woman's name is Sarah, of course, and the old man's name is Abraham, and they're laughing at the idea of a baby being born in the geriatric ward and Medicare picking up the tab. They're laughing because the angel not only seems to believe it, but expects them to believe it too. They are laughing because with part of themselves, they do believe it. They're laughing because with another part of themselves, they know it would take a fool to believe it. They're laughing because laughing is better than crying, and maybe not all that different. They are laughing because of some by some crazy chance it should happen to come true, then they would really have something to laugh about. I love the story. The promise, the disbelief, the laughter, the wanting to believe the promise, and the uncertainty about the promise. And I love the end. God says to Abraham, why'd Sarah laugh? Duh. One would think the creator of heaven and earth would know why a 9-year-old woman would laugh if she was told she's going to have a baby. But then Sarah denies it. Oh, no, not me. She said, that wasn't my laugh you heard. And then God, almost with a twinkle in the divine eye, says, oh, yes, you did laugh. Who writes this stuff? I mean, that is priceless, give and take. Yes, so, so honest. And of course, 3 chapters later in the book of Genesis, God does for Abraham and Sarah just what God promised. And interestingly, the son, Isaac, his name means laughter. Now, I'm not sure what you all think of this ancient story with God promising and doing some wondrously weird things. And yes, we are sophisticated people of the 21st century. We know biology. 90-year-old men and women in this church, and we have some very active ones, and they often have reasons to go to the doctor. But I suspect maternity and pediatrics are not departments in which they spend very much time. But as I read this wonderful story, I'm reminded of a phrase I've shared with you before. Some words of a Native American storyteller. I don't know if the story happened exactly this way, but I know it's true just the same. I don't know if the story of the birth of Isaac to elderly parents happened exactly the way Genesis says it happened. I don't know if his parents were really over 90 years old, but I have no doubt that the story is true. Why? Because this story witnesses to an inscrutable power that refuses every definition, every domestication, every effort by us to contain it within our definitions of what is realistic and possible. It speaks of a God, of one who enters into situations where change seems impossible and who works a change. Where hope seems ridiculous and who brings hope. Where all possibilities have been exhausted and who still manages to open the way to something new and unexpected. One who finds a way when there is no way. In the words of biblical scholar Luke Timothy Johnson, these texts shatter the structure of my unbelief. My idolatrous hold on my own interpretations of the world, my own despair at the lack of the world's possibilities. They say to me, this is not a closed system, but one open to its creator whose possibilities are endless. And so, even as old Sarah is laughing, she's adding baby diapers and baby shampoo to her shopping list. She seems to understand that with this God, there's always a new future, with new possibilities. With this God, there is a surplus of surprises that outrun our capacity to control or predict or explain. I think of my own despair at the seeming lack of the world's possibilities. The feeling that maybe it's too late for me. The gnawing fear that the future ain't what it used to be. Ever feel that way? Ever feel yourself kind of caught up in the world of woulda, coulda, shoulda? Haunted by the ghosts of so many deferments? But that's precisely why the Noahs and the Abrahams and the Sarahs and the stories they tell are so important to us. They can liberate us, you see. They can open us to miracles the world says are impossible. I ask your indulgence for a moment as I get just a little personal. As I was working on this text, I was thinking back to a horrible summer 16 years ago. My younger sister had died following her struggle with cancer. My older sister was struggling with grief and a number of drug addiction issues. I had a niece descending into alcoholism. And my mother had begun her long, slow decline, at times that summer spending entire weeks in bed. It appeared my father was coming apart at the seams, and who could blame him? I remember visiting him at some point that summer, and we were talking. He just turned to me, shook his head, and said, "We don't have a family anymore." Did I disappear? I have to say. At first, I was a little hurt. You know, what about our children, about his other grandchildren? We just chopped liver. But, you know, when I stepped back, I could understand. He had been through so much, was going through so much. The future seemed closed to him. Things had been so bad that there seemed to be no possibility of change or newness entering in his life or our family's life. This is as good as it will ever be. Not even God can get us out of this one. But that long and dreary summer 16 years ago is why the last few weeks of summer 2012 have been so important to me. As some of you know, my brother-in-law, Charlie, after these 16 years, finally met someone, and at the end of July was married and invited me to come and officiate at the service. Our entire family, all the folks from California came, Southern California came, Becky came down from Oregon, his children, of course, came. All there. And for me, at least, as I stood there that day, it really was an affirmation of hope, of new beginnings. A statement of faith in unexpected possibility, a new future for our family. And so I leave this summer with the feeling that, you know, that we're going to be all right, that our family is growing, is healing, and facing the future with a new hope. Only wish my father could be a little more hopeful, but we're working on him. But again, you see, this is why these stories are so important. You may or may not want to take them literally. I don't care. But I hope you take them seriously. Because the stories are relentless. They refuse to allow us to give up or give in to the world as it is. In the words of Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann, the God who can give a baby can give anything. The God who can work this new life can work new life in every circumstance. The bounds of possibility are forever broken. This is not confidence in human technical capacity or ingenuity or human wisdom, but amazement about the power of life at work beyond our management or control. Every aspect of life is now set to lyrics that invite celebration and amazement. But again, I know we talked about it this morning before in our Bible study. It can be so difficult to believe in the promise of possibility, to live that promise, to trust that promise, to be shaped by that promise day by day. And let's be honest, many of the powers of the world don't want us to believe it. They want us to believe that their definition of reality and of what is possible is the only definition. Because if we lose our stories, we're so much easier to control. And we may even hear it from our own families. Don't hope too much. Don't dream too much. You'll only be disappointed. And so we find ourselves caught up with this kind of inner dialogue, and one voice saying, "Can you imagine?" The other voice saying, "Yes, but..." Turning to the New Testament, we see this all the time with Jesus and his disciples. They are always filled with the grudging hesitance of "yes, but." Jesus comes and says, "Can you imagine a dinner where everyone is invited, where everyone is welcome? Can you imagine a blind man able to see or a prodigal welcome home? Can you imagine lepers healed, widows cared for, poor people made first-class citizens? Can you imagine a world where the peacemakers, the meek, the wounded and the hurting really are blessed?" And they say, "Oh, sounds good. Yes, but..." Everyone knows it isn't possible. Fortunately, Jesus always ran powerfully ahead of their fear, their uncertainty, of all their yes buts. And he runs ahead of ours as well. He always seems to want to overcome our tightly disciplined, fearfully guarded notions of what is possible. Can you imagine a world where all people, young and old, can have decent and affordable health care? Yes. But consider the cost and the overwhelming number of people who need it. Can you imagine a new world where there is food for all? Yes, but... what would it mean for our standard of living? Can you imagine a rehabilitated marriage or a new relationship with an estranged or troubled child? Yes, but whenever I try to reach out, he or she always... Can you imagine a life that is more meaningful and fulfilling? Yes, but there's so many day-to-day responsibilities, so much to be done. Says Brueggemann, when we have our lives governed by yes, but, we're resisting God's power for newness. We deny God's freedom to give gifts. We end the song, stop the lyric, we deny the truth of our stories, and just hold on grimly. But holding on grimly is an act of atheism, governed by yes, but. Believing there's no more than what we can explain, no more than what we can control, manage, and predict. Abraham and Sarah, you begin to understand why we need to remember and retell these old, old stories. The memory of what was allows possibility, makes room for God's transforming present reality into something new and holy. Abraham and Sarah. Their story is an invitation to believe and trust, indeed to take some risks along the way. An invitation to receive God's newness that goes against all probability. An invitation to relinquish our yes buts and instead dare to sing songs, receive gifts of grace, make journeys, dare to confess more than we understand and claim more than we can explain. Because this is God's world. This world is not closed, not finished. And every moment of life carries within it the seed of promise. So let us remember our stories. And let us dare to celebrate miracles the world says cannot happen. And anticipate possibilities the world says are nothing but bad jokes. Because just when we have convinced ourselves that there is nothing new under the sun, that this is all there is and all that ever will be, 90-year-old Sarah walks into the living room with a smile on her face and says, "Abraham, I have something to tell you."